Miss Farnborough, Reel 14.
Central and most necessary part of our work.
In
and
a
they
helpless...
very often had to come before any bandaging, because it depended on the state of the men. We could see if they were pain-racked. We couldn't leave them, bandage them easily and quietly, while the men were being convulsed with pain.
In a hopeless case, did you ever give them an injection of too much morphia, perhaps?
That
to
never.
Help them die
that
more quickly?
Never. That never. I would have wished, but we didn't go so far as that. I would have wished, instead of giving morphia, not to have given morphia. To have let them die in their comatose, half... I don't know quite well. They were practically dying, and yet to give them an injection was to restore them to an instantaneous consciousness again. When they would know they were dying, they would feel the pain. We never, never, never would give them too much. On the contrary, it would be not giving that would allow them to pass quietly. But, as our doctor said, it would be against all the ethics of the Red Cross, knowing that when a man was still alive, one must do everything in our power to keep him alive.
When I talk to the English nurses, I always ask them if they had dum-dum bullet wounds to deal with, and they normally say, no, of course not, but I think you did, didn't you?
Yes, we had one or two, and they were carefully noted by our surgical team. We had to notify our doctors at once, and they wrote all details down and had, in most cases, the photographs taken. Because it had been come to the knowledge of many, many of the surgeons in the various Red Cross units on the front, not only on the German front, but the Austrian front too, that dum-dum bullets were being used. They're a ghastly thing. The aperture and the outlet are completely, they mess the flesh and bones into a pulp, you know. It is a dreadful thing to look at. The only thing is, of course, complete amputation. I don't think anything is illegal in time of war. I think man's brutality and savagery can be given full rein to, which I'm sure it is. Because there is nothing and no one for them to say stop here or stop there. I think there is no limit to any kind of brutality in time of war. If there is one missile more deadly than the others, it is usually the most popular one to use.
Well, then why weren't dum-dum bullets used more often?
Because we have had a different code of honour in warfare. I don't think they would ever have been used, even in the First World War, on the Western Front, either by the French or the Belgian or the English. I am sure of that. But you see over there, it was a case of... Well, they were so... intent on destroying Russia and throwing all their manpower from the Eastern Front onto the West against the invading Allied armies, that they stopped at nothing. They were quite, they would have done anything. They would have used probably dum-dum bullets all the time if they could. But their shells, the long-distance shells, were terrible. They gave the soldiers gave a name to it, Chemodan. You may remember that name. Chemodan means heavy shell. I'm not quite sure how you would find it in the dictionary. It might be just shell, but it was more than shell. A Chemodan is a thing which devastates 50 times more than an ordinary shell. They just called it heavy shell. And I remember one instance when we were bandaging people in a round, in a very out-of-the-way place, and the enemy were shelling us. And then this tremendous whistling thing came towards us, and the most unearthly bang, that everything shook, house, floor, earth, sky, everything. We were shaking too from the... It was a dreadful thing. And the one or two of the soldiers said, "Chemodan." And when you looked round, when things had quietened down, they had disappeared, even though they were far too weak to go, and they had not even had their wounds attended to. There was that dreadful fear of the German long-distance guns. I think they had a special name for it on the English front, but I don't remember what it was. The house, and the house was bombarded. They were not hurt, but other sisters belonging to another Red Cross unit. Curiously enough, not one of our sisters was touched. They would receive scratches or bruises, you know, but really a terrible wound like many of them. And yet we were more in the front than practically any other Red Cross unit. We were what they called the flying columns, Letuchkas.
Did you and the other sisters in your unit worry about being killed or wounded by the bombs, not necessarily out of personal fear, but just because you wouldn't be able to help the men anymore?
No, I don't think there was any worry. Someone asked me that once in another interview. They said, "Well, weren't you afraid to go to the front?" But had we been afraid, we wouldn't have volunteered. We were volunteers.
Yes, but you didn't know what to expect.
Oh, we did. We knew that war is hell. We knew that we'd be under fire. We knew that we'd be surrounded. And we were glad to think we would be able to share in those dreadful moments and help the suffering of the soldiers. Oh, there was no fear. When fear came, we were not working. Then when we had time to think, then we began to be nervous. And then nerves became frayed. And we would perhaps be rather disagreeable one with the other, you know. But when work was there, like one man, we were together, just a complete team. It was quite marvellous. And many a time I think that work was our salvation, because there were two or three times when we were supposed to be in reserve. I don't know that it was in reserve, because we used to attend to the village children and the village women and men who were nearly always ill or starving, because it was difficult to get proper food rations to them so near the front. And then, of course, the refugees hindered us many, many a time from having a rest. But there was certainly no fear, except when we had no work and had time to think. It was a very strange thing. You would have thought, oh, and then they would have rejoiced, now we can rest and all. No, we began bickering here and criticizing there. And you know, it was really very funny. And the moment the wounded men came, then we were just, I don't know, we were uplifted with some kind of strength. In any case, we never, never had a single word of conflict among any of us while work was on hand. And work was nearly always on hand, because we were there to work.
Were there any sort of precautions you could take? Any sort of shelter?
No. Well, of course, the We were organized by our surgical men, the surgeons and the head doctors. Incidentally, we called them all doctors, even though they were surgeons. They were all surgeons and they were all doctors. But they would organize it. But we could not move until we had marching orders. And the marching orders came not from our Red Cross unit, but they came actually from the military staff of the division to which we were attached. Very often we heard, such and such a regiment is going into reserve. Another regiment is coming to take its place. Please accept all wounded from such and such new regiment. And very often at a moment's crisis, when we knew the enemy was at our heels, much too near to be agreeable, and we knew that we shouldn't be able to leave even the most wounded soldiers alone there, somehow we must get them away from the advancing enemy. There were those times when we couldn't move because no marching orders had been received. And once or twice we were... It was a very critical moment. We said, when will they come? No one can tell. Will they ever come? No one can tell. If they had never come, we should have had to remain at our posts and we should have been surrounded. In some mysterious way, they did come, sometimes very late, when there was no time to take even the wounded.
So if you were under fire, there was nothing you could do. It was just lucky that none of you were ever hurt.
It's a very difficult thing to explain that, because I'm speaking mostly of the retreat of 1915, because we knew the enemy was advancing, and we knew that wherever there were wounded men, we must attend to them. But don't forget, we were always moving eastwards, and we were constantly receiving marching orders, go there, go here, go south, go north, go east, but never west, of course. And of course, wherever they sent us, we had to drop everything at a moment's notice and go. We had by us about 40 or 50 of these small two-wheeled ambulance vans, Dvukolke. They were our salvation. Without them, we couldn't have got any of the wounded away. But there were times when they had already been sent and marching orders came. And then we had to go and leave the wounded. Others would come back for them. The brothers, we were sisters and brothers in the Red Cross unit. The brothers did most of the difficult work at the front. We were... concentrating on bandaging and dressing the wounds. But the brothers would come back in the Dvukolke and would pick up, if they could, in time, the wounded men, leaving the dying men.
What can you say to a wounded man that you have to leave?
Well, many of them, of course, were desperate. We used to try to comfort them, telling, if we go, others will come and fetch you. I don't think they believed. They know perfectly well. And of course, many soldiers who were badly wounded and could not even walk, somehow they would manage to crawl away.
During the time you were advancing, you had the opportunity to see several different kinds of trenches. Russian, yes. German, Austrian, whatever. How were they different from each other?
Well, the Austrian trenches were very much better constructed than the Russian trenches. The Russian trenches, of course, it was difficult to say. When we were advancing, we in 1916, we came across remarkable trenches which had been occupied and constructed by the Austrians. In some cases, there were even gardens there, and they would...